we welcome in our friend, author Colin Fleming. Hello there, Mr. Fleming.
Hey, what's going on, Kimball?
Doing our thing here. Were you on the stairs today doing your thing?
Oh, I was on the stairs. I was all over the place. I got up. I wrote 3,000 words. I put up a blog. I did my push-ups. I ran 3,000 stairs. I just hauled ass to the Trader Joe's, and I was like that person, a creature that you're supposed to think ill of because he's a racial stereotype, but I was like Speedy Gonzalez moving through that Trader Joe's, Mr. Kimball, and it was about 90 seconds. It was impressive. And then I rushed back to talk to you.
And you were writing earlier about the volume that you're putting up here on the blog, which, and again, we've talked about it. It's a journal of what you're doing. To call it a blog is to understate it. What is it, some 50,000 words that you've got up there recently?
Yeah, but I'm loath to really go into it in some ways because it's not my work. Do you know what I mean? It's just kind of something between. So just tabulating things as I back up the blog in Microsoft Word, and you get curious. But 50,000 plus words over the last month I was there, so I just did the word count. But when I say 3,000 words today, that was to a story that is now up to 6,000 words that was started a few days ago. And then another story that I wrote and came up with and wrote in its entirety today. So over that same month, it's more than 50,000 words of fiction. And then it's all of the nonfiction pieces too and everything. So the blog is just kind of the interstitial downtime documentation of other things. It's not my actual work. It's just, I guess it just speaks to how I'm, like, even today I'm sitting down right now, and it's kind of like the first time that I've sat down and not had the fingers a moving like all day. Like, I mean, I've never spoken to you, for instance, on a Tuesday when I've had anything that day because I'm just working. I mean, that's like literally true. So it's intense, and I'm always on the go. Yesterday was 10,000 stairs because I didn't do as well as I should have done over the weekend and had to make it up. And, you probably know from the stairs that you've done that adds up. And that's kind of a hard amount to get.
Yeah, I would say so. I'm amused to hear you downtime because I know better. There's no downtime for the Sea Dog.
No, there really isn't. And the idea of sitting there and watching a game. I'm never not doing many things at once for work. And even like if I wake up in the middle of the night, my first thought, there's no leave off. It's not even a first thought. It's not even like, oh, we're thinking again. It's just kind of resumes in medias res for some novel I'm writing. Like I'm just right back in everything at once. And part of that is who I am, and part of that is the situation I'm in. But it's funny, I sort of sit back and I hear these accounts of things that people do, and they're things that I want to do, and they're very humdrum, and they represent a kind of utopia to me that someday I would drive in a car and go to Home Depot to get some like flower hangings for the house. And that's like tedious to people, but like that's the type of thing I look forward to, mm-hmm. as a normal person thing that I would just, I daydream about things like that.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. We're talking music today, and before we get into it, well, let's give a little listen to one of the most unique voices, I think, in the history of rock music.
Well, Bebop Luna, she's my baby. Bebop Luna, I don't need my baby. Bebop Luna, she's my baby. Bebop Luna, I don't need my baby.
It's a guy who burst on the scene in the mid-50s with the requisite mid-50s look, the hair, the pompadour, the leather jacket. But he was an original, talking today about Gene Vincent.
He had the look, but he also sort of started the look. It was he put a lot of that look in motion, let us say. And he had the look with the caveat because he had had his leg smashed and like the bone ground into dust in the car accident. Gene Vincent struggled with car accidents, as you know, and it was one of those deals where it looked like the leg was going to have to be amputated. He didn't want that. I guess it's comforting that it seems like you can argue with doctors and not amputating your limb. I've noticed that. And so he had this limp, and it was pronounced, and he did not let it slow him down, curb who he was, anything at all. Gene Vincent was very good at being exactly who Gene Vincent was, which sounds simple. Who wouldn't be good at being who they are? Well, most people, but not Gene Vincent. Bebopalula was his big hit. It was the one that you talk about hits from the 1950s, the biggest ones. You're going to have the Elvis, the early RCA sides. You're going to have pick whatever you want from Chuck Berry, Johnny B. Goode, Jerry Lee Lewis, Whole Lot of Shaking going on, and Great Balls of Fire. And Bebopalula, Tutti Frutti, is in that same category. And it's really the one big hit he has. He doesn't have the sustained run as a hit maker. He has a very short life. He dies at only 36 years old, and he has all of these difficulties and tragedies, but it never gets in the way of Gene Vincent doing what he wanted to do, doing it. You mentioned his singing voice, and it's one of the all-time great voices in rock and roll. And he had come up to Elvis Presley, actually, at one point, and he said, like, hey, I apologize. That's just how I sound. I'm not, like, trying to swipe your style. And it's kind of it shows that he had some doubt in some sense, because he doesn't sound anything at all like Elvis. And Elvis was gracious. He said, no, I know, man. You're just doing your own thing. But that bit you played there, there was no one, really, maybe Little Richard in his way, who thought of singing in such a distinct manner as Gene Vincent did at the time.
Interesting, too, because that debut album of his with the Blue Caps, Blue Jean Bop, was produced by Ken Nelson, who had quite a career in country music. He worked later on. He was part of that great Bakersfield sound with Buck Owens and Merle Haggard, and also produced the great Stan Freberg and all of his comedy work back in the 50s as well. But he got some great performances on that debut album with a wide range of musical styles.
Oh, definitely. And it's one of those albums from the 1950s that really stands up as an album. Oftentimes, back then, albums were your singles and their B-sides and whatever. You jumped into the studio and you knocked out some covers, and they were mostly all of it in the same vein. That's Gene Vincent, for such a hell for leather rocker and this questionable guy in some regards. I mean, he always kind of had a dodgy reputation, and that's why, like, guitarist Cliff Gallup, the great Cliff Gallup, was like, well, you know what, I'm about 5 years older than this guy. I don't know if I need to be hanging around him that much, and he left the band. But you get these ballads mixed in with the Hellcat rock and roll numbers. And you mentioned country, and country is never really that far from early rock and roll. I think that's something that's important to keep in mind. The blues is never far, of course, and rhythm and blues. But Gene Vincent and Elvis and Buddy Holly, obviously Carl Perkins, there's a real country element. Country is integral to rockabilly. Rock and roll, rockabilly, Gene Vincent was a master of both. And you also have, I think, one of the finest guitar albums in all of rock and roll. When we line up the guitar albums, what are they going to be? Obviously, Are You Experienced by Jimi Hendrix. And we can put in, let's say, Live at Leeds by The Who. And we can put in whatever you want by Cream. Call it Fresh Cream, the first album. Put in even a Byrds album in that 12-string Rickenbacker attack. But I think you have to have this album is representing the early rock and roll movement. Cliff Gallup, the guitar player here, who was on 35 tracks with Gene Vincent. So he did these nine sessions, really three extended sessions, but total nine. He played so fast and so clean, this amalgam of country picking, but also like what you're going to get later on. It sounds strange with someone like Alvin Pena after. He's just clean and he's fast. And Jeff Beck thought the guy was the bee's knees. He was as good as it got.
Oh, his work on something like Race with the Devil And it's just classic. And then Cliff Gallup has such an interesting personal story too. He did those 9 sessions and then pretty much walked away from the music business.
Yeah, he had other things that he wanted to be doing, but he was one of those players. So it sounds, again, paradoxical, but you wouldn't almost think that someone could play that well back then. Like, it's supposed to be rudimentary, right? And guys play, and it's raw and all of that. You don't really associate that prevailing rawness with chops. Cliff Gallup was a virtuoso. Like, as an actual player, okay, I've done this. And in Race with the Devil that you mentioned, it was the first song that they did together. And lined up in the studio as backup was a guitarist in case Cliff Gallup couldn't play well enough. So he plays the solo on Race with the Devil, and, you can go home.
Yeah.
Turns out we don't need you. And then after that, they're into Bebopalula. And the thing about Bebopalula is, note how Gene Vincent, he's driving the song with his voice. He has these great screams that trigger the guitar solo. But he's also letting the song dictate how he's going to handle the vocal. He's so confident when he sings. The way he slurs, the way he elides, it's just this natural feel for music that only the best singers have. You wouldn't think that you could talk about Gene Vincent as a singer and Billie Holiday together. They sound so different. They're doing totally different things. But they're similar in this particular regard. And so it's thrilling to hear someone do something that well. I mean, so if, like, you were John Lennon, you heard Bebopalula, it was going to be one of your all-time favorite, like, core collection, top 5 recordings of all time. But that particular album, Blue Jean Bop, you have Ain't She Sweet, which the Beatles did, and the pre-fame years, of course, and that they revisited later during the Get Back sessions, and Wedding Bells are breaking up that old gang of mine. It's one of those songs that, like, Elvis had a kind of, like, high school song, farewell old high school type of song he'd do, and the Beach Boys sort of had one, and this was a version of that Up a Lazy River, where this almost drunkenly somnambulistic vocal is employed by Vincent. But then you have just like the ravers, Blue Jean Bop, Jezebel, Who Slapped John, Bop Street, and note too the idea that these guys, they bop, they're always bopping. Blue Jean, you'll hear Gene Vincent say, it's time to bop. It reminds us that Charlie Parker and Bop, it was more than just the jazz thing. It was a kind of just amped up, energetic, musical, and even existential ethos. Bop itself, jazz bop, is like 1945. Well, here we are in 56, and the bop is still going on, and it's still valid bop, but it's a long way from like Dizzy Gillespie, Charlie Parker doing Coco.
A couple of great performances, and man, what a treat it was to listen to some of these other shows that Alan Freed did in 1956, Alan Freed's Rock and Roll Dance Party, and a couple of great performances. And boy, that's the other thing, listening to that and then watching the performance on Italian television, you get a taste of what a great live performer Gene Vincent was.
Oh, definitely. And so the thing about these Alan Freed broadcasts from 1956 is no one knows they exist. I mean, they're out there. They're not hard to find. Nothing is said about them. Nothing is written about them. They sound almost too good to be true, don't they?
Oh, yeah.
You go to 1956, listen to Alan Freed, and it's live recordings by people like Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers, Chuck Berry, and, of course, Gene Vincent. You get live performances by Johnny Burnett and the Rock and Roll Trio during the same... no one talks about these things as existing. I don't think anyone's really aware of them. You get Alan Freed doing his, like, crucial... We've spoken so often about radio history, and normally we're talking about dramatic programs or sci-fi programs, horror programs, whatever. This is radio history of a different stripe. This is, like, the kind of DJ, who, of course, is going to get caught up in payola and disgraced and all that stuff later on. But it just isn't mind-blowing that you could even hear Alan Freed doing his thing at the this crucible moment of rock and roll. I mean, 1956 is year one for rock and roll. Right.
Now, that's it. You're present at the birth right here, listening to these guys do it live with a disc jockey who, you know, I think without his influence, without his willingness to play some of those songs that were called race records at the time, I'm not sure rock and roll comes along when it did.
Oh, Count Basie? The show, when the show started in earlier in 56, Count Basie was on it.
Yeah.
And Count Basie was having something of a renaissance in his career. Because he wasn't Bob, of course, but he had been a swing musician, and swing had a hard time after the war when the smaller ensembles came in. But both, well, Ellington always was able to stick around, and Basie was having his resurgence. But then you start getting these live rock and roll. So you get the screaming crowd, the kids. And you have Alan Freed himself very amped up. I mean, his throat is raw. He's introducing these performances. He says, go, and you go. So Gene Vincent and the Blue Caps, Cliff Gallup is still here. They do Hound Dog. How about the live version of Bebopalula? They're not, like, very far into it. When all of the people in the audience are going berserk and clapping along. I mean, really, it's tribal, isn't it?
Oh, for the people who thought that rock and roll was the devil's music, boy, listen to that, and they might have had a case at the time.
The energy. Now, you listen to certain tapes, certain live recordings, and you can feel the energy in the place. A great example is the show that the Stone Roses gave at Glasgow Green in June of 1990. And people were wondering if they were any good live anymore, if they could still do it. They had this famous gig at Spike Island that didn't really work out. And they come out and they're playing under a big top tent, and it's really hot, and there's sweat, and it's so gross that the sweat is actually it's coming down like rain from the top of the tent. And they go into the opening guitar riff, and the crowd is singing along to the riff. It's just primal. It's everyone is in this same headspace, and that's what's happening with this version of Bebopalula. And Vincent realizes early on, because it's Gene Vincent, and he just starts doing his thing. It takes you over. It's physical. We talk about, again, music that you feel in the chestal cavity. It's physical. It's popping you in a good way. And so, again, though, no one talks about this. And when you read about it, if you do, like if I brought it up with somebody, it almost sounds like, well, that can't possibly be true. It must be a recreation. Like, otherwise, someone would have written a book about these broadcasts or something like that. But no, you can go listen to Gene Vincent live in year one of rock and roll, and you get Johnny Burnett in the rock and roll trio of all people on the same bill.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Thing. Yeah, absolutely. And then Otis Williams too, live on that same show.
Yeah. It's crazy. I mean, the fidelity is perfect. And, I don't know. It's like, think about that. It's akin to Up Goes the Rocket or whatever. And the first guy steps out on the moon, and you're like back inside, and they're saying, you want to come out? Do you want to check this out? See what's going on here? I mean, you're really rock and roll. It existed in a way, and Maybelline and had come out before this. And you had rhythm and blues, and Elvis, he left Sun in what, 1955.
Right.
So those were the first, or
blue suede shoes had just come out.
Yeah. So this was just this sort of recognized year. It's weird how that works out, too, that you could have rock and roll before rock and roll. But really, it is 1956 that you recognize. It's like, I mean, the British invasions, 1964. They just have a year. And this was the year for rock and roll. There's a lot of dross, too, but because people didn't know what they were doing with it or how far you could take it. And this was decadent stuff at the time, and you didn't want your kids listening. I mean, Gene Vincent, remember, Gene Vincent looks like a guy that you want to have parental supervision with, right?
Right.
He's around your kids, or he's having a cigarette outside the schoolyard. Somebody's maybe calling the cops on Gene Vincent. And there were all of these things that were said about him, too. He's always in leather. I know how I picture you right now. I know you. It's warm.
I know you're all in leather. That's your thing. You get it. Gee, Vincent, he was that way. Could you even imagine him, like, in a flannel?
No. I mean, right? No, no, of course not. Like, no. No, not at all.
You know how in Help, the Beatles, they all, like, sort of, like, live in the same place, and they sleep in beds next to each other? People thought that's how the Beatles actually live. I picture Gene Vincent waking up in the morning in his leathers. And also, the rumor was that he smelled terribly, and he didn't care. And this is something that I love about Gene Vincent. I love Gene Vincent for the same reason I love Dave Kingman. You know, Dave Kingman is like, mighty home run. I am devoting my life to you. Whatever anyone says in criticism of me, it doesn't matter. My sweet fair won the home run. Gene Vincent was that way with rock and roll. He just was rock and roll.
That and pulling guns on people later in life. But that's a story for another day. Also, some great recordings and fascinating conversation, although he was a man of few words in those days, on this BBC show from 1960, Saturday Club, which happened, I think these recordings were only about a month before another bad car accident with Eddie Cochran, the accident that killed him, and the Zelig of rock and roll, Sharon Shealy, who seemed to be everywhere in those days.
Yeah, it's March 1960, a couple of sessions. And so I think this is cool because, remember, people like the Beatles and Jerry and the Pacemakers and all of these soon-to-be-eventual upstart guitar bands, they're hanging on the radio, so to speak, listening to this wild guy do his stuff. Now, the way it worked, when you came over as a Gene Vincent or a Jerry Lee Lewis from the States, and you were going to play in England, you just came over, and you had to find guys to play with when you were there. And think about this. It makes, not just in England, but really in Europe, Germany, it makes something like Jerry Lee Lewis's Live at the Star Club album more remarkable, because that's not like his band. It's just some English kids called the Nashville Teens, confusing. And he dragged that performance. You go and you make one of the best live albums of all time, and it's really like you and a Rent-A-Band.
Yeah, and Gene Vincent, he's playing with Marty Wilde's band?
Oh, yeah, and he's getting it out of them. He's always getting... Gene Vincent always thought great stuff out of guitarists. You have Joe Brown, and I think that they were just jazzed to be with Gene Vincent, and they wanted to impress him. And you're hearing him do these songs that just meant so much to that nascent rock and roll movement in England. I mean, and people don't talk about that either. What you heard on the BBC, people often think with rock and roll, the BBC didn't get started until the Beatles came along. That's not true. There was all of this cool rock and roll on the BBC before that, and it was vital to the development of that scene. It was legitimate. It was the BBC. I mean, things were changing fast. Think about this, 1960, okay? So things are staged, and you're still getting Gene Vincent. He's still, like, busting through as Gene Vincent. That would have been inspiring. It would have signified freedom to those young listeners who wanted to get into rock and roll, encouragement to them. And he's always giving, I mean, Gene Vincent can't not sing exceptionally well.
Yeah, and speaking of that, let's listen to some of his other work, because he was such a multi-talented vocalist. And for people who only know him for Bebopalula and maybe a couple others from the early days, give a listen to, I think, an amazing version, a little bit of Over the Rainbow.
Somewhere over the rainbow way, up high, there's a land that I've heard of once in a lullaby.
The man could sing anything, Colin.
Yeah, he really could. And that's something that I think we tend to suggest more in a certain awestruckness than we do in terms of literal truth. But here it is, closer to that literal truth. And when Judy Garland sings her versions of Over the Rainbow, I always feel like she's singing a sort of lament. It's a blues. It's speaking to where
her character isn't in where that character would like to be. What's interesting about the Gene Vincent version is I feel like he's singing to actually get himself there. Like it's part of his means of transportation. If I sing this way, I will end up in this place where things will be better for me. He sings it with that level of commitment and earnestness and faith. And it's such a naked performance because he's in his leathers as he's singing it in all probability. Listen to the falsetto he employs. Yeah. Listen to what we might think of as feminine touches. He has no embarrassment. He has no shame. He is pure in his art. And really, how many people can we ever say that about who make art? But we could say it about Gene Vincent. So much respect for someone being like that.
I went down a Gene Vincent rabbit hole last night, and it was wonderful. I found a cover of a song that a lot of people did. I think Andy Williams, of all people, had the biggest hit version. But put that up against Gene Vincent's 1966 cover of Lonely Street, and man, it's not even close. There is so much emotion and just soul in that recording. And then, a great song that I think was the title cut from the last album he released shortly before he died in 1971, called The Day the World Turned Blue.
There was some pain in his art, certainly, and he was able to channel something inside of himself, channel something about what he'd been through. I mean, and let's keep in mind that his career didn't go the way he wished it to. He kept at it, but it's really that hit. He was in that second auto accident, and it killed the next day, Eddie Cochran. So that was something he carried around with him. And he was watching these guys like the Beatles go out, who loved his music so much. And I'm sure they wished that he could have been more successful, but having a level of success that he never approached. And he stuck at it. He was devoted. He had purpose. And so he could take you down Bop Street. He could take you down a lonely street. He was just someone you journeyed with, and his career morphed. And when I sent you that clip, for instance, of him in Italy in 1960 from television, and people really should go check this out.
Oh, yeah.
He's limping around. He can't move that well, but he moves so much. Look how into that he is. He's in the leathers. He has this dangling medallion. I don't know what that's about. It's like a loner from Dracula, right? It's the type of thing that Bela Lugosi would wear in a Dracula film. And I don't want to say that like you're embarrassed. You're watching someone just be so comfortable with themselves. Like, you don't know what's coming next. You don't know. Is Gene Vincent going to start pleasuring himself on the stage? What's going
on? The other thing I noticed too were his interactions with, and I don't know, I don't think that was Cliff Gallup on that video in Italy, but the guitarist, and all it made me think of is, wow, well, now I know, you know, where Jagger got his shtick with Keith, because it was right there.
Yeah, how could you not play well when Gene Vincent is cajoling you with his eyes and his thrusting body? I mean, he's like right in this guy's face, right?
Bro, writhing up against him, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, give it to me. Give me that guitar, bitch. Like, it's really this kind of strange. I mean, it's awesome. But I've never really seen anyone else do it like Gene Vincent does there. And everyone else around him, they're not in the leathers. They're all kind of like, I don't know, collegial, that sort of thing.
Right.
It doesn't stop Gene Vincent. He's the type of guy who would just walk into any room of suits, and he'd be in the leathers, and he just would start gyrating up against. He's like, Bop Street. I think that, again, it's the purity. It's why I love Dave Kingman. Same reason I love Gene Vincent. A little bit different, but it's cool. I mean, come on, when you watch that, don't you think, like, yeah, man, that's inspiring? You don't have to keep things under wraps. It doesn't mean that, like, you throw off your clothes and you run down Hanover Street. I'm not saying that. But we're so buttoned down, Kimball. And this guy was just teeming with life, and he let it out in all of the different forms of his art and how he performed on the stage. I just think he's so cool.
Yeah.
You know what? He doesn't get the credit. It's always Elvis and Buddy Holly and Jerry Lee Lewis. And I understand that. But he belongs
at that level of the Pantheon.
Absolutely. Well, do yourself a favor and do what I did. And, jump in, go online. It's all there. Listen, of all of them, those Alan Freed recordings are just amazing. But check it all out and realize what a colossal talent this guy was. If all you know is Bebop Alula, do a little digging into the career of Gene Vincent. Next week, with Colin. Looking forward to this. We talk about one of the great movies of all time, 1947's Out of the Past with Robert Mitchum and my secret dead actress crush, Jane Greer.
Oh, you won't believe the photo I found of her last night, Kimball. I'll send it to you. She's holding two puppies, and I can see why Mitchum was duped into that bad scene. But you said it. It's not just people always remark that it's one of the best film noirs and definitive film noirs. We're not doing that. We're looking at it as one of the best American pictures, hell, pictures ever made, period. And we'll get into why.
Looking forward to it next week. Thank you, Colin.
All right. Sounds good.
Colin Fleming every Tuesday on Downtown.